Hey everybody, how's it going? Every time I touch something, I'm getting shocked, and I don't know why. It's extremely unpleasant. So hopefully I won't get any more shocks now that I've sat down and we're getting things going. We've also had a boil order on our water here for the past few days. Nobody told me, and I've been drinking down probably all kinds of microbes. But I'm still here, so we're happy and we're feeling good today. Episode 14, here we go. So due to the unprecedented snowfall that we had in my area last week, we ran out of water, and the National Guard had to bring more water for people to drink, like out of their faucet. And I normally use a pure water filter anyway. So I was drinking filtered microbes, but it wasn't boiled microbes. So there's no telling what's going on. I don't know how they disseminate that information, but I didn't receive it. So nobody told me, and I'm just, you know, I'm glad I'm still here. I'm glad that I'm not having violent convulsions now, but, you know, maybe we're not out of the woods just yet. I don't know. Last week, I did a little rundown of all of the international listeners that we had in the past 7 days. And in the past 7 days, we've had a lot of the same countries tuning in. But in addition, we've also got Japan and the UAE, in addition to India, the US, Canada, Poland, and Sweden. So that's cool. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I would love to visit Japan. And, you know, all those other places too, but I've always dreamed of visiting Japan one day. Today's drink is Suja, organic green juice. Oh man, I forgot to do my jingle jangles. I shouldn't have even brought it up. Anyway, today's drink is Suja organic green juice. I'm drinking the Mighty Dozen green juice, and it's my favorite. It's very good. It's nice and dark green. It's got like spinach, apple, kale, collard greens, spirulina, which is really good for you. Chlorella, all kinds of good stuff, ginger. It tastes amazing and it makes me feel so good. So drink up Suja Organic Mighty Dozen if it's available in your area. So I've been thinking about the fact that we're probably going to be able to go back to the movies this year, and that's really exciting, I think. I love going to see movies in the theater. When I lived in New York, I would go all the time by myself and just go in the middle of the day, see a matinee, and see an art house flick, usually. I didn't really like going to the multiplexes there. Plus, there's so many good small theaters in New York. I mean, why not? But going to the movies by myself is something I guess I've always done. I remember one time whenever the new Thor movie came out, I don't know, I guess it would have been the second Thor movie, and I lived in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I remember I went to like a 9 a.m. showing by myself, sat in the very back. I was probably one of three people in the theater, and I brought breakfast tacos in my backpack, and I sat in the back corner and ate breakfast tacos and thoroughly enjoyed the Thor movie. And that was a great time. So I really love going to the movies, and I can't wait until we're in a situation where we can go back freely. But I was also wondering, am I the only person who gets freaked out in the movie theater if you have like space behind you. Because it's been since I was in high school probably when I started with this like unease in the movie theater. But I like to sit in the back row because that way nobody can creep up behind me. And I just wonder if I'm the only person who feels this way. Sadly, though, in America, like, you are at risk of getting shot up whenever you go in the movie theater. So that has not done much to, you know, calm my anxiety about that. But I will say in New York City, I never worried about someone shooting up the theater because people just are not walking around New York City with guns like they are in other parts of America. But like in Georgia or in Louisiana or any place like that, you know, Colorado is where they had that mass shooting at the movies, at the Batman movie. Any state like that, I think you've got to be concerned on some level about like a freaking, you know, something just fucked up happening. And actually, I went to see a special screening last year. It wouldn't have been last year because COVID, 2019 maybe. I went to a special screening in Georgia of Apocalypse Now, which is one of my favorite movies, one of my favorite Kubrick films. Definitely one of the best war movies of all time. So I was really excited to go watch it. And the theater was packed, packed with men, with people, but mostly men. And I honestly could not enjoy the movie because I was just feeling like tense about the situation. Because I was thinking like probably just crazed bitter loners are the people who are going to see Apocalypse Now in the theater. And I'm like the rare exception of just like a regular person who wants to go see this on the big screen. No offense to the guys who were there that day because nothing happened, of course, and it went off without incident. But I just wonder if I'm the only person with extreme anxiety about the movie theater. And I wonder in other countries if people worry about that, you know? I've never gone to a movie in another country. I've got to add that to my list. I want to go to see a movie in a theater in another country. Just to check out the vibes. Also, things really went sideways for me in my movie watching career when I started going to theaters that serve alcohol. Like, we had an art house theater in Little Rock when I was like high school, college age, and they started selling wine and beer. And wow, it was like, it was a great time. But then I would like fall asleep during the movie because I drank like 3 glasses of wine and then the movie was long. You know, next thing you know, I'm snoring. And then I'm like, was the movie good? Because I kind of went to sleep for a few minutes. So, and then like when I moved to LA and I started going to movies out there, I was like, literally, I would drink 3 glasses of Chardonnay during a movie and then like just not even know how I felt about the movie by the end. But I just felt like I had a good time, you know? But I don't think that's a habit I'll be carrying forth into my movie watching career. So probably just they don't need to serve alcohol at the movies. Like, are you going to watch a movie or are you going to take a nap? Because if you're going to take a nap, then it's a good thing. Otherwise, it's not good for your focus and your concentration. Speaking of, I started reading my book, Quit Like a Woman, and whoa, it's crazy. I'm like 4 chapters in, 5 chapters in, and I can't put it down. It's like so full of groundbreaking information that I've never heard before, and it's extremely relatable. Because the author talks about, you know, some of the things that she's been through that led her to quit drinking and the way that actually, like, women in this wine culture of, like, women have, like, a wine glass that says mommy juice on it. And they're like, oh, yeah, my kids, that's the reason why mommy drinks. And, like, just this whole, like, age that we're living in right now where it's just commonly accepted that everyone drinks, and especially, you know, it's being marketed toward women in the last, like, 20 or so years. It's pretty interesting. And she compares, well, actually what made me think of it just now was the way that she talks about how alcohol affects your brain. I was like, oh my God, this is wild. She called it the equivalent of like a neurological sledgehammer. Alcohol on your brain. It affects every part of your brain. Like from your memory to your personality to your decision making. That's why whenever like if somebody wants to bring up something that I did when I was drinking, and I hate whenever people are like, well, that's the real you. You know, like you said all this and this and this, and that must be how you really feel. Like, I don't even think I would say that, honestly. Like, I don't even think that. Why would I say that? And that's just like a horrible place to be, first of all. But secondly, there's some science behind it, apparently, because it affects every single part of your brain. And I also learned that it can cause you to not get a good quality of sleep, even if you only have one drink, because it keeps you from getting, you're supposed to have 7 cycles of REM sleep each night. And if even if you only have one drink, you can get like 2 cycles of REM sleep. So you never go into a deep sleep, even if you've only had one drink. So it's pretty mind-blowing, honestly. And as you guys know, I've been like going back and forth kind of on this, like trying on not drinking alcohol and wondering like what my relationship with it will be in the future. And the more I read this book, the more I'm like, holy shit, why would I ever want this? So I don't know. I'm still a little confused, but I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I'm really enjoying the book, and it is kind of geared toward women, but it's also just interesting in general. Like she compares the business of like big alcohol to big tobacco and how like, you know, like, is it possible that alcohol is going to go the way of cigarettes in like 20 years? Like how it used to be commonly accepted that people would smoke cigarettes inside everywhere, on planes, just wherever the hell they feel like. I'm old enough to remember when people would smoke inside restaurants and they had a smoking section and a non-smoking section. Which like what the hell good does that do? It's cigarette smoke. It's not like it just sits in one place. But like people were actually, you know, that was common. And now like you would just be shocked to your core if you walked into a restaurant and saw someone sitting there smoking. You know, whereas it used to be like not only commonly accepted, but encouraged to the point that like big tobacco were running ads with people dressed up like doctors saying like, yeah, it's good for you, even though there's evidence that they knew it wasn't good for you even at that time. But, you know, commerce is the most important thing to rich guys who are wanting to get richer, I guess, at any cost, which is sad. But, you know, I just wonder if alcohol is going to go the same way eventually, where now people don't smoke cigarettes as widely or commonly as they used to. It's kind of, you know, it's viewed differently now than it was back then for sure. But is this going to go the same way? Is it going to become you know, not as cool of a thing to do to get drunk anymore. I don't know. I think there's a case to be made for it, for sure. For, you know, as a society of people not including alcohol in everything, like going to the fucking movies, okay? Do we really need wine at the fucking movies? No. The answer's no. But something else that I read in this book that has absolutely just pinged my brain and it's still reverberating throughout was the moment where the author talked about how she had gone on a trip with a buddy of hers, a male friend, and other friends as well. And he was telling her about a friend who wasn't there. They'd gone to Mexico to a resort. And he was talking about his friend who wasn't there because he has a problem with alcohol. So therefore, he can no longer go on trips with his friends because he can't control his alcohol consumption. And the author was like, damn, like the stories that he's telling about this guy could just as easily be about me. And, you know, like he can't come on trips anymore because he can't drink alcohol anymore, or he's decided not to drink alcohol anymore. And then after the woman, the author, quit drinking herself, she was then uninvited on a trip to Italy because the friend said that he wanted to take someone else who drank. And I think that's definitely a valid fear for someone who wants to come out as sober. And honestly, I'm not even gonna lie. I have been that person before who judged people for not drinking or thought that they weren't fun or, you know, like, what are we gonna do if you're sober? Like, I wasn't interested in dating a sober person because I was like, you know, what will we do together? Like, how will that be fun? So I definitely understand that feeling. And also, the author also posits that, you know, the same way that you don't call people who smoke cigarette-aholics, you shouldn't call people who abuse alcohol alcoholics, because alcohol is, at the end of the day, an addictive drug. And we should treat it as such. And it should be that we have people in society who are drinkers and people who are not drinkers. And that there's nothing wrong with being a non-drinker. And that it doesn't make you weird. And that as soon as you turn 21, you're not obligated to start getting shit-faced because it's the right thing to do. And also something she talks about that is really interesting to me is that there is a feeling which I can't say that I have been a party to this specifically, mainly because I don't have any friends anymore, but that whenever somebody who used to drink socially or heavily or at all, someone who used to drink decides to quit drinking, that other people take offense to it because other people sometimes don't want to look at their own relationship with alcohol. And I've been there too, you know. I get it. I get every side of this scenario. I'm a well-seasoned drinker and then some. So I get it, but it's just interesting to see somebody talk about this intelligently and say, just to articulate everything that I've been feeling and thinking and going through. And it's pretty cool. So anybody, I would say male or female, who is interested in some of this stuff. And I think that the listeners of this podcast are interested in it because, again, my episode that I did about drinking has been the most popular of all my episodes so far. So clearly this is something that a lot of people, I mean, it touches everyone. It touches everyone, whether or not you continue to drink, whether you're thinking about stopping, whether you know somebody who's stopping and you're choosing not to stop and you're trying to navigate that, or whether you're just considering, you know, what's best for you. It really does touch everyone because alcohol is the most widespread legal drug that's available to people. That's a whole other issue, but I'll talk about that another time. The legality of alcohol and the illicit status of other addictive substances that people don't make billions of dollars every year off of. So also, I was listening to one of my favorite podcasts, besides this one, obviously. Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. And he had on Kevin Hart, and Kevin Hart was talking about working with Will Ferrell, and he talked about the movie Get Hard, and I'm in Get Hard, and I was thinking, I should talk about Get Hard for a second, because I totally agreed with what Kevin Hart said, and I saw it firsthand as well, working with Will Ferrell. He was just talking about how creative Will Ferrell is, and like comedic, in a comedic sense, how he can just come up with things off the cuff. And like I said, I saw that aspect of him as well. And it was honestly one of the coolest experiences I've had thus far in my life working on a set. I had some like stupid character name, one of those that you're not really proud of having on your resume because it just sounds stupid. It was like white girl or like junkie girl or something like that. Biker girl. I don't remember honestly, but I was one chick in a crew of like a biker gang in this biker club that Will Ferrell infiltrates. And Get Hard is a hilarious movie, so definitely you should watch it if you haven't seen it already. Just overall, it's just a fucking hilarious movie. You've probably seen the part where Will Ferrell's sitting in a massage chair with a glass of wine, it's just splashing all over his face. Anyway, I was in this biker club, and Will Ferrell comes in, and he's like asking for protection or something. And basically, all the bikers converge on him, and they think he's a cop, and they are thinking about just killing him. And then Kevin Hart bursts in and saves the day. So I had, I think, one or two. No, I had at least two scripted lines in the scene. But I learned that the script didn't really go that far on this movie. Will Ferrell and the director, I can't remember his name off the top of my head. But it was very interesting to see how they worked together, because Will Ferrell would walk into the scene and the camera's on him, and he would say whatever was in the script. He would deliver the line, and then the director off camera would shout to him different variations. And then he would think about it for a second. And then he would do it again. And then the director would tell him another variation. And Will Ferrell would think about it for a second. And then he would do that one. And they were all just like hilarious ad-libs, hilarious like versions of the original thing. And I had never seen that done before on a set. I guess I had never worked on, have never worked on like a large scale, big budget comedy like that with huge comedy stars. And I thought it was really cool. And then the big moment came. It was kind of like a fluid kind of operation of getting through this initial scene that I was in. And they were like, okay, somebody has got to get the money. Will Ferrell's giving money. And then they were like, okay, you go up and get the money from him. And I was like, okay. So we started doing the scene. And then I went up to get the money from him. I just said something because everyone was improvising and I felt comfortable to just do it. And I went up and I was like, give it here, asshole. And he like gave me the money and he was like genuinely surprised that I had said that because he wasn't expecting it. And then after we cut, Will Ferrell was like, asshole. Really? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, that was so funny. And I was like, thank you. Thank you, Will Ferrell. And then I almost died just right away because I couldn't believe that Will Ferrell told me something I said was funny. And it was amazing. He was very, very nice. And then also, though, in that scene, it was kind of weird because there were a lot of topless girls. And this was, of course, before the Me Too movement, which some of the things that went on even like 5 to 10 years ago would never fly today. It seems like it was 100 years ago in a way because of how much things have just changed in a matter of like 10 or whatever years, however many years it's been since the Me Too movement started. But there were a lot of topless girls in the scene, like extras that were just sitting around with no top on. And they would just continue sitting there like that in between takes or in between setups. And I think like a couple of them would get like a, I don't remember what you would call it, like a courtesy cover in between. But some of them didn't care. And they were just perfectly fine to sit there topless for hours and hours on end. And I remember thinking that was a little unusual. And there were a bunch of dudes in the room, like a lot of them. It was supposed to be a biker gang party. And that was a little uncomfortable to me. Like I could see some of the other, not any of the main actors, some of the like minor players that were there just like staring. And I was like, ew, God, these poor girls. But they seemed fine. I doubt that would go over in today's day and age, though. And then there was this huge explosion. Kevin Hart's character comes in and explodes the door. And that was really fucking cool. Yeah, cool movie. Funny movie. And Will Ferrell told me something I said was funny, so I will hang on to that, probably to my deathbed. And rightfully so, honestly. I mean, why shouldn't I? I hope I haven't already talked about that before, because that's super embarrassing if I have. Anyway, if I have, just pretend like I haven't. Okay, I don't want this to sound preachy at all, but I feel like I should talk about this because it is a subject that I do feel passionately about. I want to raise awareness about milk, okay? And don't get offended right away if you love milk and you drink a huge glass of milk every morning. It's okay. Just hear me out. So somebody recently was talking about how they were talking about Fairlife milk, and they were like talking about it like it was like a really nice, highly sought after brand of milk. And I was just amazed by that because I know that a few years ago, Fairlife milk came under intense scrutiny because this horrific video came out of the treatment of the cows at one of their supplier farms. And it was honestly like, I would not tell anyone to watch it because it was really, really sad. And these people were just like kicking these little cows and like hitting them and punching them. And like, just, it was horrible. Absolutely just disgusting. And it was a big deal at the time because Fairlife, they have like a little picture of a cartoon cow on it. And it's supposed to be like, I mean, the name is Fairlife. It's supposed to be like a company, a milk company that advocates for the animals. And like, what a fucking slap in the face that this is happening at one of their suppliers. And people are buying this milk thinking that they're doing the right thing whenever actually like just horrendous stuff is going on at this company. So actually they had a lawsuit, like a class action lawsuit from people who bought the milk saying like, we paid a premium for this milk because we thought that it was nice, you know, and that you guys were treating the animals well. Clearly you're not. And we want restitution. And I'm actually not sure how the lawsuit shook out. Ultimately, I think they fought it and they said that that supplier was only responsible for like a small percentage of their milk and blah, 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 blah. But the point is, regardless, you don't know what's being done to those animals. Like even a company that pretends like they treat them really nicely, the milk is not organic. You don't know what's going on behind the scenes. Okay. And this is just confounding to me that, and I said something about this, you know, I was like, oh, don't you know, like that company is actually like, we know for sure, because we've seen a video now, we know for sure that they are abusing animals, like in the process of getting this milk. And I thought that people would care about that. And like, if anyone knew, or if the people who bought it knew, surely they wouldn't continue buying it. But I realized that a lot of people do. They just keep buying it. And even at like, you know, large scale dairy manufacturers, who knows what's going on with those animals? This is just one company that even was marketing their product as treating the animals fairly was treating them horribly. So what do you think is going on with the mass production, like major manufacturers of dairy milk? I mean, it's honestly, it's mind-blowing to me that more people aren't outraged about this. And maybe it's just an issue of awareness. That's why I felt the need to discuss it today. Because there's, in 2021, there's no reason that anybody needs to keep buying dairy milk. There's no reason. So as for me, at the grocery store that I go to, they have milk, dairy milk, they have organic milk. You know what else they have? And you know, I know how this is going to sound, but they do have oat milk and they do have hemp milk. Hemp milk has like almost the same amount of protein as regular milk, and it has more health benefits than drinking dairy milk. And it tastes better. I hate the way dairy milk tastes. And I feel like it makes me sick. So, okay, are you lactose intolerant? Then why are you drinking milk? You know, like, do you go to a grocery store where you have alternatives available? If the answer is yes, then why are you still buying dairy milk? There's no reason. You can swap it out for, in cooking, coconut milk is a fantastic substitute. You can get it in a can. It's shelf stable. You can keep it in the pantry. It doesn't go bad. It's a no-brainer to me. You like milk in your coffee? Try an oat milk creamer. It tastes great, and it doesn't make your digestive system ill after you drink it. I mean, this I do not understand. It's not like you're asking people, or I'm not asking people to be vegetarian or vegan. I'm not. I eat meat. I eat dairy. I eat cheese. If I get, you know, I try to get, like, if I'm buying sour cream or something, I try to get organic because I feel like that's the best thing I can do in that situation. But as far as milk, there are so many fantastic substitutes. It's just one simple switch you could make that would make a difference. If everybody, every consumer who buys gallon jugs of dairy milk started buying milk, dairy milk alternatives instead, that, I mean, money talks and bullshit walks, okay? Put your money where your mouth is. That's what makes a difference. There's no reason for it. It's just a simple thing that anybody, most people could do, you know, that would not affect your life in any way. And you would be doing a huge favor to the dairy cow community who never asked to be relentlessly milked and tortured so people could drink their milk. Again, I'm not asking people to give up dairy. I'm not asking people to even give up meat, okay? Just swap out the dairy milk for a different milk. There's so many available. Are you allergic to almonds? Great. Try cashew. Try oat. Again, try hemp. Hemp is the best one, I think, and I use it in cooking as well. It's a one-for-one substitute to dairy milk. What's the excuse? What's your excuse? If you're in a place where you truly do not have access to an alternative, then fine. I mean, do what you have to do. But if you live in a city or a place where you can go to the store and pick up an alternative, then please, please just consider it. That's all I'm asking. Just consider it. Do you remember what Joaquin Phoenix said at the Oscars a few years ago? Let's hear it. Wow, it's called The Speech That Broke the Internet on YouTube. Let's hear it.
I think that we've become very disconnected from the natural world. And many of us, what we're guilty of is an egocentric worldview, the belief that we're the center of the universe. We go into the natural world and we plunder it for its resources. We feel entitled to artificially inseminate a cow, and when she gives birth, we steal her baby, even though her cries of anguish are unmistakable. And then we take her milk that's intended for her calf, and we put it in our coffee and our cereal. We fear the idea of personal change because we think that we have to sacrifice something to give something up. But human beings at our best are so inventive and creative and ingenious. And I think that when we use love and compassion as our guiding principles, we can create, develop, and implement systems of change that are beneficial to all sentient beings and to the environment.
Okay, that's enough. You see what he means, though, right? I mean, I think he said it quite well, honestly. And also with, as is the case with cows that are being raised for meat, they take up a huge amount of resources, dairy cows as well. They take a huge amount of water and feed. and they release a lot of carbon and methane into the environment, which contributes to climate change. So it honestly is like a multi-layered issue that we can easily overcome. And I just think that more people, hopefully, should be considering in this day and age, caring about nature and caring about animals as much as you care about yourself. And like I said, 2 times already, I'm not saying change your entire lifestyle. Just switch it out for a milk alternative. It's an easy change. Easy. It requires almost no effort on the consumer's part. You just take your ass over to the aisle that has all that stuff on it. It's very easy. Okay, moving on from that. I hope I didn't piss anyone off, but if I piss people off, you know, that's the price you pay sometimes, and I'm willing to pay it. So, whatever. If you're pissed off, go get a glass of green juice and think about your life. Okay, one last thing for today. I have, I got for Christmas the Criterion Collection of Ingmar Bergman's cinema. And you can probably hear in my voice how absolutely exciting this is for me. I was waiting to watch it, start watching them, until I got finished watching all the movies that I had to watch at the beginning of the year. I think I'm probably allowed to say now I was on the SAG Awards nominating committee, so I had to watch a lot of movies to vote on who should be nominated for SAG Awards. So anyway, I had to wait kind of, or I felt like I had to wait until I was finished with that before I could start watching a lot of other movies. Anyway, I started watching last weekend. Ingmar Bergman is a Swedish director, and he is not alive anymore. He died in like 2007 and he was in his 80s. So, he has a huge body of work and he's a very influential director to many other, you know, directors that we now love and admire. I think his work is very interesting. And like I've talked about before on the show, I really like the Scandinavian sensibility when it comes to films and posing big questions, philosophical questions, and not necessarily answering them for you and leaving you to draw your own conclusion. And also just framing things beautifully, playing with lighting, you know, treating it as theater in a way. And Ingmar Bergman was very good at all of that. I guess most of his films are black and white. And his most well-known film probably is The Seventh Seal. The famous movie where the character played by Max von Sydow encounters death and plays a chess match with death. Anyway, so that's why the movie that I'm recommending for you guys this week is Smiles of a Summer Night by Ingmar Bergman. It's from 1955, and I know I normally recommend contemporary new movies, but you know what? Broaden your damn horizons, okay? Watch an old movie. Stand on the shoulders of giants. Ingmar Bergman is a giant. And it definitely watching classic cinema and foreign film is very important, especially in the general like dumbing down of society that we're experiencing right now with, you know, everything that's gone on politically in the last several years. And, you know, like, do people read books anymore? Do you read classic novels anymore? Does anybody read anymore? I just read an article this morning about how But I mean, I read the article on my phone and it was saying that whenever you read, it changes like the neural pathways in your brain and it develops like new skills. It takes your brain and allows it to build neural pathways that enable you to consider high concepts and to think things through on the macro level. And it also said skim reading on your phone doesn't count. So people being addicted to the phone, that changes your brain too. I have a book about that that I haven't started yet. It's on my shelf of books that are all being neglected as I take, you know, my time getting through all of them and continue to order new books and then shove more of the old ones to the back. So, you know, like this is important. It's important to read, you know, new contemporary books are good as well. All types of books are great. But it's important to read, like, if you're an actor or filmmaker, it's important to read plays. Read old plays. Read Chekhov. That's something that my acting teacher instilled in me. And, you know, my dad, to some degree, from a very young age, was always encouraging me to watch classic cinema. So if you're interested in, you know, this line of work, especially, but just as a human being, like absorbing classic cinema and, you know, plays and novels and all different types of consumption of art and reading are all good things to expand our empathy as human beings. And that's more important now than ever. Smiles of a Summer Night is considered by Bergman a romantic comedy, but would probably be considered by an American audience to be more of a dark comedy. It has funny moments. It's about a bunch of men and women couples who are trying to navigate their relationships with one another. And it's very interesting to look at. They have all these elaborate costumes, elaborate set pieces, and all of these, I think it's four separate couples, end up coming together in this one house for a weekend and, you know, wild shit ensues. One lady who's part of one couple is another guy's mistress, and that guy's wife is somebody else's love interest, and it's just crazy. Bergman said that he wanted to take four couples of one man and one woman, shake them all up, and see what happens. But also interesting about this film, because the Criterion Collection that I have came with this massive book, with all of these essays that were written about Bergman's work and then like pieces of interviews and things that he said himself. And a couple of interesting things about this that I thought were really cool. Before he made Smiles of a Summer Night in 1955, he had already made, I think, three or four features, but they hadn't done well. They were extremely dark, serious, dramatic pieces that were not well received by the public. And the production company that he had been working with, called Svensk Film Industry, told him, you know, we're not giving you any more money to make movies if you make another one of these fucking dark dramas. So he was basically at the end of his rope. He weighed 125 pounds and he was a very tall man. He had gotten very ill. His stomach was aching constantly and he was convinced that he was dying of cancer. And so it was a very bad time in his life. And he decided to go to Switzerland to either kill himself or write a film. And he decided to write a film. And after he made Smiles of a Summer Night, it was well received, but the production company took the film to Cannes, to the Cannes Film Festival, and did not ask his permission, did not work with him on, you know, the plan of the submission to the festival and the ensuing, you know, campaign that would inevitably come. And he said that he read about it in the paper. There was a headline that said, like, Swedish film makes a big splash at Cannes. And he was like, that's wonderful. I wonder what filmmaker that was. And what, I'm so glad, you know, for a Swedish film to do great. And then he read the article and it was his film. And he was like, what in the actual fuck? And he was also, like, super broke, had no money at the time. His films had not been making money. And he was dating a woman named Bibi Anderson at the time, who was an actress that he was one of his muses over the years that he frequently worked with. And she had been working as an actress and actually making money. And he borrowed money from her for the plane ticket to go to Cannes and try to make something happen. And he did. And he said that he never had to worry about getting his films made ever again because of that film being a success. So check it out. It's a cool movie. And let me know what you think. You can email me at podcast@raiden.me. Also, I just want to say I find this inspiring because Bergman was like 37 years old at the time that he got Smiles of a Summer Night made. And like I said, you know, he hadn't been, you know, hitting it big with his previous work. So for anybody who ever wants to do anything, just keep in mind for, everybody who finds success straight away when they're 21 years old, there's always a Bergman as well, who it just takes a little bit longer, but there's never an age to make it doing what you want to do. There's never a cutoff. There's never a deadline. You just keep doing you. Be open to whatever comes, and keep working. There's no reason not to. Okay. So with that, I will leave you. I will send you back out into the world, hopefully better than you came. And let me know how you like your hemp milk and your cereal. Email me at podcast@raiden.me. Feel free to drop me a line, ask me a question, send me a comment. Just don't be rude. And you can be rude if you want to. It's fine. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a fabulous rest of your day, and I will see you here next week. Bye.